You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just ahead this hour, we go into the world of essential oils, how they're farmed, how they're foraged, what part of the plant they come from. Join in on Essential Oils, 800-642-1234. But first, since the start of this year, Republicans and state legislatures nationwide have introduced more than 100 bills that would negatively affect transgender youth. And similar proposals in Wisconsin stand little chance of becoming law with Democratic Governor Evers in office. But as Christine Hatfield reports, transgender youth have still felt the impacts. Parents and children shared their stories with WPR's Wisconsin.
Bailey Mosling of Middleton considers himself Wisconsin's premier drag teen. Right now, he's working on decorating a pink motorized toy truck that he's going to use for a birthday drag show later this month.
I'm a pro. Hey, calm down, everyone.
On stage, he goes by the name of Nemo.
My performances are, like, thought out and have, like, a storyline and are, like, very, like, theatrical at some points.
Off stage, Bailey is like many other people his age. He says growing up is hard enough, but as one of the estimated 150,000 transgender teenagers in the United States, he faces challenges many other teens don't.
It's an interesting thing to have, you know, like, my rights and, like, my, like, identity be up for debate.
Earlier this year, Republicans in the state legislature introduced a bill that would ban any sort of gender-affirming care for minors. That could include taking medication that delays the onset of puberty and hormones like estrogen and testosterone.
It was, like, a few weeks after I'd started hormones, and so I was like, oh my god, I spent like all this time just for it to be like taken away from me. And so I was scared, yeah.
Bailey says he first found the language to describe himself in a book he read in the sixth grade about a gender-fluid teenager.
1 minute after I finished it, I like went back to the first page and like started reading it again. And then like after I read it again, I remember putting it on my mom's like pillow or something. And saying, like, can you read this?
Bailey's mother, Dana Mosling, says there are many hurdles in getting gender-affirming care for minors. Bailey started to socially transition in seventh grade, but it took a year to start puberty blockers. 2 years later, he started testosterone.
There's a reason that it takes that long, right? And a lot of it is, you know, making sure that you have the correct providers that you can have that those kind of relationships with.
Dana says all the work Bailey has done means he knows more about himself than many of his peers, and it's been freeing for him.
There's no longer this insane need for discovery or figuring things out, and you can then just unfold and exist, right? Exist and unfold and develop, you know, into the human you are going to be.
Now she says politics are getting in the way.
The fact that our kids' existence is this political debate right now. I mean, that's a stressor that most families never even have to deal with.
Megan McDonald is the executive director of LGBTQ advocacy group Fair Wisconsin. She says many major medical associations agree that gender-affirming care is safe and medically necessary for the physical and mental health of transgender children.
There's no reason why that needs to be, you know, random strangers in the legislature should be allowed to weigh in on that.
Wisconsin's bills focused on trans youth are going nowhere for now, but they could be reintroduced next year when split control of government is far from guaranteed. That makes Bailey nervous.
If it were to be like that, these like bills passed and I can't get the like care that I need, then like a physical part of who I am like wouldn't feel right.
Bailey says his identity isn't political to him.
We're not like trying to like change the world or anything like that. We're just like trying to live just, you know, in the way that feels most comfortable for us to live.
For now, Bailey's trying to focus on finishing 10th grade and figuring out what he wants to do after graduation. He's also looking ahead to that birthday drag show. Christine Hatfield, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And the parents and students who shared their experiences with Wisconsin made this story possible. It is part of the Wisconsin Project. And for more information, visit WPR.org/Wisconsin. Now to essential oils and how scents influence us. They carry the essence of a plant, or another way to say it, they're concentrated plant extracts, and their labels may promote potential benefits like relaxation, elevated mood, pain relief. What are some of your favorite essential oils? Do you use them topically on your pulse points, maybe, or put drops in a diffuser? How does it make you feel? 800-642-1234. Jane Holly Stevens owns Four Elements Organic Herbals. It's a 130-acre farm and apothecary in North Freedom. Jane, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I'm happy to join you this morning.
Well, give us a fuller picture, if you will, of what essential oils are.
Well, as you mentioned, they are extracted from plants if they are pure essential oils. So I have a still here in my farm and grow various aromatic plants. But I am looking to make hydrosols, which is a byproduct of essential oils. And so how they're made is, like I would harvest maybe a 30-foot row of lavender and put, well, my still is about 6 gallons. So I would fill up this container that's full of holes. It's kind of like a sieve, and fill that, pack that full of the herbs, but loosely enough that steam could go through. That's inserted into a larger container that has like 4 inches of water on the bottom. And then that is sealed except for a condenser, which comes off the top. So what happens is you boil water, but the herbs are not touching it. It's in that container, that sieve container. So this steam can rise up through the plants and lift off all of the aromatic qualities or the volatile oils. And it goes into the condenser, which... has cold water running around it. So the steam turns into distilled water, and that's what you capture. And then out of that, maybe 6 gallons, I get about a teaspoon of essential oil.
I've heard it takes enormous quantities of plant material to make some essential oils. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was blessed enough to go to Grasse, France, the perfume capital of the world. And they have just fields and fields of lavender. That's what they're known for. But, you know, they just, out of all their stills, you really capture just a small amount. Like roses, you would need, I don't know how much out of an acre of roses you would get. And then those all have to be handpicked at the right time. It's a tricky business.
Wow, that's immense, immense labor. You know, as a consumer, how do you identify then good quality essential oils? What should you be watching for?
It's really tricky. You know, I found even some of the suppliers I trusted, it turned out that some of my essential oils weren't pure, so we had to switch suppliers. But because there's no regulations on this and there's no labeling requirement, So the way to find the good one is to do your research. You're going to really have to get on it and, you know, read about each company and where they are getting their essential oils from, because it's kind of a rodeo out there with the essential oils companies.
Is there an expiration to essential oils? Do they ever go bad?
Well, if they were left open or in the sun, they would degrade. But there is a wonderful quality about them that if they're stored properly, they can last for years and years. The seat of aromatherapy or distillation came out of Egypt. And some of the bottles, the old bottles, still had remnants in them, and they could still detect the scent. So, it's really... it's an amazing way to capture the volatile oils of a plant.
Some people think that essential oils waste natural resources because they may use too much plant materials compared to herbal oils or teas, perhaps. So what does the environmental sustainability, the footprint of essential oils, look like to you?
Well, I agree with your comment that, you know, typically what we should just try to use the whole plant, because think of all the irrigation and all that water, and especially if these crops are not grown organically, all of that extra nitrogen is going to be washed into the waterways. So I agree that it's more sustainable to just make herbal teas or infuse your scented herbs into oils. That's a much more sustainable route.
We're discussing essential oils with farmer Jean Holly Stevens. She's been growing organic herbs and marketing herbal products in Wisconsin for over three decades. What do you want to know about how essential oils are made? Do you have questions about the ingredient list on your favorite essential oil? How does it make you feel when you use it? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Jean Holly Stevens here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about essential oils on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. After I exercise, I reward myself with a dab of essential oil fusion on my wrists. My favorite is a mix of lavender, lemon, and balsam fir. It reminds me of like this peaceful, serene forest. Do you have essential oils? How do you use them? If you had a stressful day, do you think lavender or patchouli help your body relax? Join in 800-642-1234. Jean Holly Stevens is an organic herb farmer and with us for about nine more minutes. So, Jane, you know, there are health effects of essential oils, and I'm wondering that when you hear that they promote pain relief or promote better sleeping or stress relief, you know, what should we think about with those, you know, how those benefits are posed to us?
Well, yeah, we have so much at our fingertips in the 21st century, don't we? I mean, it's just amazing. I have essential oils, and I love your description of how you reward yourself after a workout. And, you know, I think of that, you know, I've looked at my essential oils and thought, I feel like a queen that, you know, just picture like queens in Egypt way back when could feel just so special, like nobody else had the essential oils, but they did. Like they would have hundreds of people collecting them for them. And then they were the ones with them. So I feel like a queen when I get to handle these essential oils and use them. And I think really that's the right way to think about them, that they're extra special, that you should save them for those special moments. I love that you use it after a workout. I think for everyday use, you know, we could make teas, we could make our aromatic oils and infuse effective herbs into oil and use that topically. But I think it is delightful, and we can really feel glorious with the fact that we have these at our fingertips, but to use them respectfully in that way.
So when they're in the air or being used topically in a cream or a lotion, can you explain a little bit more about how you should apply them to skin?
So you use, when you want to scent your cream or your oil with an essential oil, so for about 8 ounces, you would use one dropper full or 20 drops,
okay,
which is the same as 1 milliliter. So you use them sparingly, but it is really fun. You can feel like your own alchemist when you blend some of these things and come up with your own blends. Like I was really intrigued with your blend, for example. Like I never made that blend. That sounds really interesting.
I think you should give it a shot.
Yeah, because it has the top notes, which pop first, the lemon,
mm-hmm,
you know, the mid-range, which I think you said lavender.
Yes. And then the balsam fir.
Yeah, which is the base note, which grounds it, and that holds it, stays for a while. So when I was in France, we did a perfumery class, and they had, it was called the organ, where they placed all their essential oils according to the top, mid, and base notes. And so, you know, as I said, the top notes pop out, and then the base notes kind of hold it together. I mean, sorry, the mid range, mm-hmm, hold it together, and then the base notes stick around. It's kind of like orris root, which is a fixative that helps the whole blend stick together and last longer.
And we love that lingering effect as well. Let's take a call now. Diane is with us in Madison. Diane, hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I want to say, first of all, good morning, and you're providing us with a sweet day.
Oh, thank you.
I am co-owner of Unified Cleaning Services here in Madison, and during the winter, we learned that we could remove salt stains from rugs, from carpeting, by making a solution of water, white vinegar, and a few drops of orange essence oil. And what the orange did is removed any traces of the vinegar smell. The vinegar and water did their trick on the rugs. We would take a clean cloth and rub up the solution, get it as dry as possible. The salt would come off of the rugs. And the orange gave a beautiful smell to the room.
Ooh, what a great tip. Have you since been using this in other cleaning products?
No.
Okay.
We make a lot of our own things. And, you know, we use a lot of vinegar. We use Dawn in toilets. And that does the trick. In fact, at home overnight, I take some of the solution of vinegar and Dawn and put it inside the toilet bowl, and it brings up any kind of stains, any kind of calcium. That's a you know, we're not talking about now the oils. I'm giving a pitch for a commercial product.
But I appreciate
we're spreading the love all around.
Well, Diane, thank you so much for the call. And I'm wondering if you, Jane, have seen how, you know, to use an orange essential oil. What you think about there?
Well, I have to agree that the citrus essential oils are great for cleaning. They really take out any oil, like, you know, any kind of oily stains. And they're just like, they're so potent that they really work well for cleaning. And they leave that great refreshing scent too. Like, who doesn't love the scent of a citrus? So I thought that was a great tip as well.
When you go through this process of making essential oils, is it finicky? Is there any part of the process that could go wrong for you that you have to really pay attention to?
Yeah, you really got to stick around when you make essential oils or hydrosols because, well, it's temperature. Like, in fact, the reason they call it a still is because you should do it on a still day. So if there's any breezes going on that can help delay the process. It keeps the flame from, you know, boiling off the steam as quickly as it should. But yeah, this is a process that you have to be very attentive to.
What is your favorite essential oils? What are the ones that you really covet?
Well, lavender is just a go-to. Like, when I travel, I'll always bring lavender. And I don't know if, you know, so if you get out in the sun too much and you feel, I mean, this is my favorite use for lavender besides it's so calming. You know, actually, I'm so blessed. I'm squeezing a lavender flower right here that my friend grew in his greenhouse. And so I get to sniff it while I talk about it. But anyway, it's so good for if you're out in the sun and your skin starts feeling like you've had too much sun. If you can get some lavender on there, especially in a carrier oil, you would be shocked to see how quickly you recover from excess sun.
You mentioned hydrosols. What are they?
So when you make the essential oils, all the steam that comes out besides the oil that floats on top of it, that's the hydrosol. So as I mentioned, the steam comes out and the essential oils just float on top of the hydrosol. So if you have a really hot, sunny summer, you're going to have more essential oils than if you have a cloudy, cool, because that's what kind of amps up those in the plant. So it would vary from a gallon of hydrosol to get a teaspoon or to a tablespoon of essential oil.
As we wrap up, Art, do you have any tips for putting essential oil drops in a diffuser, and really applying it to a space, a room?
Well, I think it's better than those chemical scented things. And so yeah, just use them, you know, as needed. And I think that would be a great thing. But Kate, I would really like to invite all of your listeners to have an open farm day where they can actually meet and smell all these. It's definitely a scratch and sniff tour.
Scratch and sniff day. When is it?
Yeah, it is. It's June 11th from noon till 4:30, and everyone's welcome. It's free and open to the public.
Well, Jane, good to talk. Good to talk with you. We have a link at our website. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for your time.
You too. Jane Holly Stevens owns Four Elements Organic Herbals. It's a farm apothecary shop in North Freedom. And just ahead, a neuroscientist joins us to explain the science of smell. We learn about why COVID is changing the way people smell and taste. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We explore the science of smell and fragrance in our daily life on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So people report losing their sense of smell or taste after a COVID infection, and the severity is varying from person to person, but symptoms can affect your quality of life for months after having COVID. Have you experienced anosmia, or that abrupt loss of smell or partial loss of smell? What was that like? Do you appreciate aromatherapy? What drew you to it? 800-642-1234. Psychologist Rachel Herz is a neuroscientist specializing in the science of smell, on the faculty at Brown University and Boston College, and author of several books on smell. Rachel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's great to be here.
Well, give us a peek into the science of smell, and how does it, you know, that sense of smell work in us?
So the sense of smell is one of the most interesting, I think so, and complicated senses that we
You are biased.
Not at all biased. So actually the way it happens is every time we breathe, and we breathe in about 23,000 times per day, some of that is while we're sleeping, so that doesn't count, because we actually, while we're in deep or dreaming sleep, we actually cannot perceive smells, contrary to popular assumption. You wake up and smell the coffee. It's not that the coffee smell wakes you up. But in any event, while we're awake and breathing, we inhale chemicals that are in the air, and the chemicals are what are stimulating our sense of smell. So our sense of smell and our sense of taste are stimulated by chemicals. With taste, it's chemicals that dissolve in the saliva in our mouth. With smell, it's chemicals that flow through the air that we inspire through our nose. And also, actually, while we're chewing food and have food in our mouth, those chemicals actually also reach the olfactory receptors in our nose and stimulate it while we're eating, and combined with taste, salt, sour, sweet, and bitter, the aroma of what we're eating creates the pleasure and sensation of food. So bacon, for example, just tastes like salt. It's the aroma molecules from the bacon that is perceived at the same time as the taste that gives us the flavor of bacon.
Wow, so there's a lot of cross-pollination going on here.
Exactly. And the really another fascinating thing about the sense of smell is that the neurons that are responding to those chemicals are actually directly exposed to the environment. They're sitting basically just at the very top of your nostrils, kind of like at the level of your eyebrow. And if you could sort of stick your finger up far enough, you would sort of be able to touch them. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the more interesting things about the sense of smell, in that we are constantly regenerating these sensory neurons because of the fact that they're exposed to the environment and get killed off by environmental toxins, smoke, pollution, and so forth. So we're constantly getting a new nose. Approximately every month or so, your neurons are totally refreshed. Although what happens as we age is that that refresh rate starts declining, and we start losing neurons more than we regain them.
Wow. So, you know, you've seen the reports in COVID, people losing that sense of smell or taste. What is that like to abruptly lose that sense?
Well, actually, it can be really traumatic. I mean, I've dealt with a lot of people who are called acquired anosmic. So that is to say, they had a normal sense of smell and then they lost it,
mm-hmm.
Either for long periods of time or even just temporarily. I mean, I had people tell me during the sort of height of COVID, when the particular variants were really frequently causing smell loss. Fortunately, the more recent variants don't seem to be affecting the sense of smell as much. But in any case, I had people who were really sick say that the worst symptom that they had was actually loss of smell, and that it really affected every aspect of their life in ways that they had no idea about. And this is the really unfortunate thing, is most people really take their sense of smell for granted, have no idea that it's involved basically in everything that we experience until they lose it, and then are just shocked by how their quality of life declines in so many ways. And one of the major reasons that it's so destabilizing and disturbing is because our sense of smell is processed in the same part of the brain that our emotions and our emotional memories and our associations are processed. So when we get a hit to the sense of smell, we get a hit to ourself and our emotions and our connection to ourselves and other people in a really dramatic and shocking way.
Wow, so really connected to emotions as well. It sounds like it affects a lot of other systems in the body, psychological systems. You know, we just heard from Beth in Middleton, who says that they have a hyper sense of smell. They can smell detergent brands, and they really can feel like they have an acute sense of smell. Is that possible?
Yeah, so in addition to the fact that we get a new nose every month, actually, we all have ever so slightly different noses. And that is to say that literally your sense of smell is slightly unique compared to everyone else's, unless you have an identical twin. And what I mean by that is that...
Oh, I think we just lost Rachel Herz as we... Rachel, are you there? I think we've just lost Rachel Herz, who we're talking with, a neuroscientist on the faculty of Brown University and Boston College, explaining the science of smell. And we're going to try to see if we can't get her back on the line. Rachel, are you there? No, we're having trouble reaching Rachel. Let's just take a moment here as we talk about the science of smell with Rachel Herz and, you know, reflecting on what happens when we smell a rose or we smell an onion and, you know, what curiosities happen and what brain processes happen with the essence of smell. Back in a minute, we're going to try to get a reconnection here with Rachel Herz, psychologist here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with cognitive neuroscientist Rachel Herz about smell, what it is. There was a study caught my attention published this month in the journal Current Biology. It finds that people around the world like the same kinds of smell, and what smells we like or dislike, that's primarily determined by the structure of the particular odor molecule. So we'll still time to talk about this with psychologist Rachel Herz. And Rachel, I understand you did a recent study about how people undervalue smell when compared to vision and hearing. What did you find?
Yeah, so this is a pretty amazing finding. I mean, I always knew that people undervalued the sense of smell, but it was pretty striking to me, especially now, given all the media attention that COVID got and people being aware of the misery of smell loss and so on. And this study I conducted, I collected the data in the spring of 2021. So, you know, people were very well aware of what was going on with the sense of smell and loss and so on. And I had two groups of participants, one basically college students and the other what I like to call real adults. So out there in the world, slightly older and more experienced with life. And there were over 400 participants in this research. And what I found, first of all, not all that unsurprising, is that the people would much rather give up their sense of smell than hearing or vision. Like 85%, if forced, would choose to give up smell compared to hearing or vision, where there was a very small percentage of people. Only less than 2% would give up vision, and only about 13% would give up hearing. But what was more striking is that I compared the value of hearing, smell, and vision to basic common commodities like your cell phone, a dream vacation, your hair, you know, your streaming service, and so forth. So just to get an idea of what the value people really place on their senses was. And believe it or not, 1 in 5 people overall would rather give up their sense of smell than give up $10,000.
Wow.
Among college students, 25% of them would rather keep their cell phone then their sense of smell. And amongst women, about half of them would rather keep their hair than their sense of smell.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, here are you have commodities that can be replaced, your hair, although obviously, I mean, I love my hair as well, but it's not doing anything particular. You know, you can get a wig, you can wear a hat. It's not like it's doing something biologically meaningful, where your sense of smell is one of the key ways that you navigate your experience in the world. And so it just was amazing to me that the sense of smell is given such negligible importance. You know,
well, it sounds like we just assume it will be there, that we kind of take advantage of it, and not until it's gone might we really understand the repercussions of not having it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's definitely the case that people who have lost their sense of smell are really taken aback in extreme ways by the devastation of it, and have really never considered it to be a worthwhile sensory system until they lose it.
Let's go to Eric and Hazel Green. Eric, I understand you lost your sense of smell when you were a child.
Yeah, I was 10 years old. I had a head face trauma. And I haven't been able to smell since then, and I'm in my 50s.
And so what has that been like? I mean, can you remember what things smell like at all?
I remember foods that I really, really liked, and I think it's probably, you know, the taste was great, the smell was great, and now, you know, since then, I can eat pretty much anything. The smell of food doesn't really make me happy or sad or anything. I've done jobs where I have to smell really nasty, well, what other people think are really nasty things, and it doesn't bother me.
Wow. Eric, thank you for sharing your story. Rachel, are there connections between trauma and smell?
Oh, absolutely. So closed head injuries are probably the very common cause. You know, people get into car accidents or even contact sports like football or soccer. If you get hit in the head around the forehead area or the back of the head around that same area, you basically can have an injury which shears off the axons from the olfactory receptors as they're going from your nose into your brain. And if there's a certain amount of trauma connected to that, what happens is the pathway between the nose and the brain gets closed off through inflammation. And you can never, even though you're regaining these olfactory receptors at the level of your nose side, they can never get back into the brain. And so that's actually a pretty typical cause of smell loss. And then probably the most common cause is what we, you know, now are so familiar with, which are these post-viral infections like COVID and other kinds of respiratory infections, well before COVID, which would do this as well. But your caller made some really good points. One, I guess, is the benefit to smell loss is being able to do jobs which are stinky and not being offended by them or really disgusted by them. But, you know, everything else that your caller experiences, and he really commented on the loss of the, you know, loving of food perception and so on. And that is actually probably what people think of first and foremost with respect to smell loss, is not getting the pleasure from food, or sometimes also not being able to detect the signs of danger. But it can really be involved in so much else. Excuse me. Like we mentioned with respect to emotion and actually personal relationships, intimate relationships, our social networks, our sense of self, our memory, and actually even our ability to do spatial skills and navigation, because it turns out our sense of smell is also connected to our ability to navigate. So people that are very good navigators also actually have a very good sense of smell.
Wow.
And people who lose their sense of smell often find really difficult spatial tasks no longer possible to do.
Let's go to Beth now in Middleton. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. What is your story?
Well, hi. You had it kind of on earlier, but it, when I called, it was when you were experiencing difficulties, and I didn't do a good enough job of explaining. My husband had about 5 years ago, his sense of smell changed to become a hyper sense of smell, to the extent that our family members have had to change to non-scented laundry soap, for instance. He just finds it unbearable, especially certain smells like floral smells. Now, you know, our concern, of course, was could he have a brain tumor or something else, and he doesn't. I mean, it's been 5 years. His health is fine. He's seen neurologists. Nobody seems to take it particularly seriously. he was told he's probably in the 1% that 99% of the people with problems, it's the other way around. But it is very, very annoying as well. It gets his attention in ways that he doesn't like. So I just wondered what your guest thought.
Thank you, Beth. Yes, appreciate it. Rachel.
So, yeah, that's really interesting, and I'm afraid I have to also plead ignorance here as well in terms of what is really going on. But it could be that as a function of, like I was mentioning, how you get this constant turnover of olfactory receptors, our different receptors are attuned to different types of chemicals. And so it may be as a function of just the neurogenesis of this olfactory system that he has a particularly high turnover right now of receptors that are really keenly attuned to the chemical structure of, let's say, floral scents and so forth. And so that he has a lot of receptors that are picking that up, and so his ability to detect them is extremely sensitive. And why that happens, I mean, first of all, I'm kind of speculating as to what is going on, but why, I really have no idea, and whether or not it will change. I mean, I suppose because it happened this way in the first place, you know, there was this change, it's possible it will change again. But my guess would just be that the representation of his olfactory receptors has changed such that he's now got many more that are attuned to these particular kinds of chemical compounds that he's hypersensitive to.
So on the other end of the spectrum, Rachel, are there ways that people can restore or strengthen their smell through doing particular exercises?
Yes, actually, this has been one of the things that have, you know, with the renaissance of the sense of smell that's come about through COVID, has also led to some really interesting, really basic treatments that people can do to improve their sense of smell at any age and at any stage, whether you've lost it or not. And this is basically exercising your nose. So what you want to do is, and this is something that I highly recommend for anyone to do, because what's also really fascinating is that doing this kind of smell training actually has the ability to increase your cognitive capacity overall. So everything that you do with your brain in terms of thinking and memory and learning can actually be enhanced by doing this kind of smell training. So what you want to do is get 4 distinctive scents that are, you know, you can buy these kits online that will help you, but you don't have to do that. You can actually just look in your house and find 4 smells that are distinctive and different. So let's say lemon scent, a floral scent, you know, some kind of a spice scent, and maybe some kind of a product in your home. Mm-hmm. And what you need to do is sniff each one for a few seconds, think about what it means to you, think about if it brings back any memories, and just sort of be with it for a few moments, and then go to the next one and so forth. And do this, you know, as many times a day as you can think of doing it. When you're doing this sort of really kind of systematic version of it, it's recommend that you do it at least 4 times a day, and that you do this for at least 3 months, and then you switch to another set of 4 scents and go from there. And even if you can't smell anything, so this is why, you know, it comes in as being very interesting from a smell training perspective for people who've lost their sense of smell. So even if you can't smell it, but you know, let's say this shampoo has a certain kind of fruity floral scent that you really like, and it reminded you of something from, you know, when you were younger, you can just think of that and know that. And it seems that it's not entirely clear what's going on. And I should actually say that one of the great, you know, advantages or kind of challenges to studying the sense of smell is that there's still a lot of mysteries that have not been completely resolved. But it seems that something is going on both at the level of the periphery, so in your nostrils and at the level of those sensory neurons, as well as in the brain, to kind of re-stimulate both the production of sensory neurons and also the interconnections between your nose and your brain to stimulate regaining your sense of smell. So this is something that I highly recommend everyone should do every day, a little bit of nose exercises along with, you know, your brisk walk in the morning.
Just fold it into your day to think about smell. And it, you know, what I hear from you there, Rachel, is to also appreciate your ability to smell and really make you more aware.
Absolutely. You know, my first book, like you mentioned, is called The Scent of Desire. And what predicated my writing it was when I was actually asked to be an expert witness for the first time for someone who'd lost her sense of smell. In this case, it was a traumatic injury, a car accident. And this person that I met, she was a young woman, you know, late 20s, had just, you know, started, she was newly married, starting a career, was planning on having a family, and everything in her life had turned upside down and in a downward spiral as a result of losing her sense of smell. smell, and she had no idea. She never appreciated her sense of smell at all. She never gave it a thought while she had it, and she was so overwhelmed by her lack of appreciation and now her current despair that I really felt compelled to make people want to, you know, take a moment and stop and smell the roses to really understand and appreciate their sense of smell.
We're talking with cognitive neuroscientist Rachel Herz, specializing in the psychological science of smell, what smell does to us, and what is happening in our brains. You can join in with your questions, your experiences with smell, 800-642-1234. Luann is joining us from East Troy. Hi, Luann. What is your story?
Hi. Thanks for this topic. I just love it. I wanted to mention that a very dear friend of mine was smart enough to give me a gift when my mother passed away. She gave me a perfume of lilac scent, and my mother grew lilacs, and our whole yard was full of them as a child. And that thoughtful gift was such a lovely thing to do because, of course, every time I smell it, I think of my mom. And so, yeah, I just loved that part of the sense of smell. But I also wanted to mention that we tried that training for my brother when he got COVID. And he's very thin to begin with. We didn't want him to lose any more weight. So I looked it up and saw that there was some research that you could retrain it. And we did it. And he got his sense of smell back, and that was a wonderful thing.
Oh, great.
And smell can be an alert for danger, too. So it's very important. People don't realize that, you know, to smell smoke or to smell that something's going wrong with your car while you're driving or that there's, you know, you're surrounded by paint fumes is so self-protective. So you need that sense.
You bring up so many good points, Luann. Thank you so much for that call. And Rachel, as we wrap up there, I'm just really struck by that perfume of lilacs, that scent of Luann's mother there really staying with her and that can stay with you for a very long time.
Yes, so I love your caller, Luann, brought up absolutely wonderful points, and I'm really thrilled to hear that smell training worked for her brother, and also her point about how smell is connected to emotional memory. That's actually what I started my research career studying, and unlike any of our other senses, smells really have the ability to bring us back to past times and spaces and places and people in a way that none of our other senses can. And so this ability to have a smell evoke a memory from your past can actually last a lifetime and be with you for a lifetime. Now, the one little cautionary note that I would say is not to oversniff the lilac, because the more that you keep smelling it, the less it will actually be perceptible to you because you'll start adapting and habituating to that scent. And also, if you keep smelling it in all different places and, you know, while you're doing different things, it can kind of rub out the emotional intensity and sort of recollection back to the past specific, like this person's mother. So just do it, you know, when you need it, not every day all the time.
Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. It was great to be on.
Psychologist Rachel Herz, cognitive neuroscientist specializing in the science of smell. Earlier, we talked with farmer Jane Holly Stevens in North Freedom. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.